history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories just waiting to be told if we take a little time to ask the questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans, those who have served our country. Sometimes they serve in ways that we didn't consider before, and we're going to hear one of those stories today. But we want to make sure that we honor that service and sacrifice, that we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we always learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And all the great ideas for this show, all the veterans you meet, they usually come from listeners. You call me, you email me, you tell me, hey, go interview so-and-so. And we've got a loyal listener in Bakersfield, California, named Bill Bliss, who said, hey, are you going to be in Utah? You got to go talk to my mom. And she's got quite a story to tell, and we're going to hear it today. Viora Bliss Baldwin here in American Fork, Utah, beautiful spot beside the Wasatch Mountains where I watched the sun come up this morning. I bet you've seen a lot of those sunrises here.
Beautiful, beautiful sunrises.
And probably a little different from the sunrise in Vail, South Dakota, when you were a little girl. How big of a place was Vail, South Dakota?
About 250 people.
Well, that's a metropolis out there.
That's the township.
Uh-huh. So what was your childhood like there? I mean, a lot of people probably couldn't imagine being in that kind of spot in that time period here in the 1920s and 30s.
We lived on a farm and just raised a variety of crops, had a variety of animals, and my dad leased the farms for a long time, then he finally bought one of his own. He lost his first one during the Depression and had to start over.
Well, and for you, I know you had some brothers who I'm sure got big and strong helping around the farm and probably just walking against the wind you get out there in South Dakota. That's enough to keep you strong. What were the chores you had to do as a little girl?
We had to help around the house, help with breakfast and make school lunches and clean our rooms. Then we had to go. Sometimes I had to milk the cows in the morning if the men were busy and feed the chickens, gather eggs. Just the normal things children do on farms.
Well, I'm sure all your grandkids and great-grandkids have grown up doing those same things, right?
Not at all.
And you only have 24 grandkids and 31 great-grandkids. I'm sure they love your stories about back in South Dakota. And I'm just curious, a lot of people today, they can't even imagine a world without a smartphone, let alone a car and a refrigerator and electricity and indoor plumbing and all that. How many of those modern conveniences did you guys actually have out there on the farm?
We had none of them. We didn't even have a telephone or a radio. We got a radio in 1935. I remember that. And that was a gift.
So no electricity?
No electricity, no telephone, no water, no running water in the house. We had to go out to the pump and get our water and carry it in the house, use it there.
So bath time must have been fun with all your siblings and your folks.
It was. We had to use our big galvanized tub, and sometimes we had to share the water because there wasn't that much water.
You probably didn't want to go last on that deal, huh?
No, but I was one of the younger ones, so sometimes I had to be last.
And what about refrigeration? Now, you mentioned milking the cows, but how'd you keep that cool and consumable?
You know, it was really hard. We had a cistern with water in it, which was usually pretty cold, and we would put a bucket with what needed to be refrigerated and lowered into the cistern. And that kept it pretty good. We never had any food poisoning or anything, so I guess it was okay.
Sometimes simple is good. You know, you make things work. You know, I've heard some stories. I don't know what it is about you folks from North Dakota and South Dakota that made you so tough, but I've interviewed so many folks in their 90s that grew up there, live other places now, but they're still going strong. And when I rolled up to your house this morning, the first thing I saw was you pushing your trash can out to the street, so I know you've still got that. But I've heard some stories about how cold and windy it could get out there. I guess if you live in a place called Vail, you expect it to be a little windy, huh?
I think so. We did have a lot of wind. South Dakota has a lot of wind, and the winters were pretty tough sometimes. I remember my dad putting sleigh runners under his hay racks to pull them out to feed the cattle. And my brother one time ran his Model T car up over the fence where the drift was so hard that he didn't fall in. And then we used to dig holes in the snowbanks for the igloos. And, you know, when we were kids, we had a lot of fun in the snow and ice, but we still suffered it. When we went to school, we had to wear dresses in school, but we had to put on our snow pants and then take them off when we got to school. And our school was an old school, so we would huddle around the radiators to keep warm.
I'm sure. And you couldn't rely on a whole lot of body heat because I think you said your graduating class was only 10 people, right?
That's right. The whole high school was less than 50.
And I don't know if this is an easy question to answer. I know it's been a few years, but I can tell your memory's sharp. Thinking about all your granddaughters and great-granddaughters and the world that they're growing up in today, and I mean, they can imagine being anything in the world, and it's possible in today's world. But what did a little girl out on that farm in South Dakota dream of being when she grew up? What kind of options or ambitions or ideas did you have in your brain?
Well, I don't remember as a child, but I do remember in high school I wanted to be a nurse. So I didn't get to that point, but I did. After I retired, I took a medical assisting course and graduated from that, but my husband died right afterwards, so I didn't have a chance to pursue that.
You mentioned your father losing the farm during the Depression, and there's another thing that us folks today who didn't live through that, it's hard for us to understand or imagine what that must have been like during those times. What are the things that stand out for you that kind of illustrate the difference between times like that and the times we live in now?
Well, as children, we didn't notice what was going on like the adults did, but we always had food on the table because we had the farm and Mom preserved foods, but we always were able to do what we needed. We didn't have very many clothes. We'd have one or two new dresses a year, maybe, and maybe a pair of shoes when we got ready to go to school, but I can't think of anything particular. I do remember one time the bank coming and getting our cows because Dad hadn't been able to pay for them, and that was a hard thing.
And you mentioned you got a radio in 1935. That must have been a big deal for a little girl to hear these sounds coming from who knows where.
It was, and my older sister had gotten married, and they gave us a radio that first year. But before that, my brother had put together a little crystal radio that he could hear things on, and it was fun to try to listen on those. And then, of course, we had the cans with a string between that we would talk to each other. That seemed like a radio to us.
It's all relative. Well, mentioning your brothers, I know you had three of them that served in World War II. Were they nice to you? They treat you all right, or did they pick on you?
Well, they teased, but as long as they were teasing me, I knew they liked me. But my older brother, I don't, you know, he was about 10 years older than I was, so I don't remember him too much because he left when he was about 17, so I didn't have him around too long. But my other two brothers teased me a lot, and we had a lot of fun together.
And back on the radio idea, I imagine that's probably how you found out about December 7th, 1941, and what happened out at Pearl Harbor. Did you hear that on the radio?
I certainly did. I was at my girlfriend's house. We were on our way up the stairs, and I remember hearing it announced that time. We were in high school.
Did you grasp that? I mean, were you able to process what that meant? Was that a shock to the system? How did you digest that news over the radio?
Well, I already had one brother in the service at that time, so it meant a lot because they were in the Engineer Corps in the National Guard, and they had been called up to go into the service. So we were afraid for them. And then my younger brother joined the Merchant Marines, and he was in that for about 6 months, and he came home. Then he joined the paratroopers. And my older brother was in college in Chicago at the time, and he joined the Navy and became a chief warrant officer in the Navy. He was over salvaging ships during the war and was in the Indian Ocean, and the Japanese came and started bombing, and they had to pull him up too fast because he was down underneath. He got the bends and was in the hospital for 6 months, and we didn't know anything about it. We knew he was missing, but we didn't know what was happening to him.
Wow. And so people understand what you're talking about. So he was actually diving on ships that had been sunk, trying to salvage different things when the Japanese came to that very spot, bombed again. So they pull him up, but the pressurization left him in rough shape. The bends is something that those divers get, what they describe the effects of the body on that rapid pressurization process. So you guys didn't know anything? Your folks didn't know if he was alive or dead?
No, we didn't. And it wasn't until the Red Cross called us and told us it was about 6 months after he's missing that he was in the hospital in India.
Well, I'm interested in a couple things on that front. One for you as a sister, knowing you've got these brothers in harm's way, and in that case, you don't know if he's even still with us. And then your folks, do you remember how they handled that? Do you remember watching them deal with this reality of three boys overseas with their lives at risk? And how did they handle that?
It was hard because Dad really needed help on the farm, and he didn't have it with the boys gone, but he was always worried about him. And Mom, of course, worried a lot. I remember she had the stars. If they had a son in the service, they had a little flag in the window with a star on it, and she was proud to put those up. But she worried about it, too.
So there are three stars hanging in the window there.
Yes.
And I'm sure as a teenage girl, you probably wonder, well, what can I do to help? You could write your brothers some letters. You could pray for them. What else did you decide you could do?
Well, at that time, I couldn't do much else. I just write letters to them and keep them informed. But when I got a little bit older, I could.
So tell me about that. What did you decide you could do? Because we've heard a lot of stories from people in uniform, men and women in uniform during the war. But a lot of people don't even realize what else was happening here in the States while those millions of Americans were overseas. Tell me what you discovered that you could do to help that war effort.
Well, my friend and I decided to go to Denver, and we didn't really know what we were going to do, but we went to the employment agency, and they had a place where we could go to learn how to work on airplanes, and I loved it. I thought it was a lot of fun. She didn't like it. She went home a couple weeks later and got married, and I stayed there, worked in the modification center. It was where they built airplanes on the West Coast and would send them to Denver to be modified. And the airplanes were, you know, full-body airplanes like the ones they have for airlines without windows. But we put gun turrets in both windows and in the top and in the tail and under the pilot. That was our job. But when we started learning, we had to learn sheet metal, how to use sheet metal, and how to work on the radios. And we had quite a good education before we started working.
Is this something you were allowed to talk about with your family, with your friends? Or is this something that you had to kind of keep a secret, what you guys were doing there in Denver?
No, it didn't seem to be any secret at all. We all talked about it openly. Everybody knew what we were doing.
And we're going to learn more about that when we come back with 93-year-old Viora Bliss Baldwin of American Fork, Utah, the different skills she had to master as a Rosie the Riveter, the other nickname she and her fellow Rosies ended up sewing on their overalls in honor of their crew chief, and before we're done today, her sentimental journey to Washington, D.C. with Utah Honor Flight. Find photos of Viora and a video explaining how she keeps track of her 24 grandkids and 31 great-grandkids at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.